I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today we have with us author of Midnight in Mexico, Alfredo Corchado, who happens also to be a very good friend of yours, right, Ben?
Right, and he lives here part-time in Mexico City, and he's really, truly someone who's binational.
And also, for the poem of the week, I think I'm going to read a poem by Pablo Neruda.
Who's that?
It's some Chilean dude. He won this prize. What was it called?
Something I think it's like called the Nobel.
Nobel Prize in Literature.
Yeah,
or something.
It's all coming
something
back
tiny
to me.
Like. I mean, it's not quite the Hudson Prize like I won.
I know.
You know, but you know, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
Today on Poetic License, we are happy to have Paisley Rekdal talking about literary obscurity.
So stay tuned.
We're going to have a great show. Alfredo Corchado, author of the amazing book Midnight in Mexico, shows a lot about the drug wars and about himself and about wanting to return to a Mexico that doesn't exist.
So keep listening. This week on Words on a Wire, our guest is Alfredo Corchado. He has been a journalist for the Dallas Morning News for the past 20-some-odd years, covering Mexico from Mexico City. He was born in a village in Mexico, moved to the United States when he was a boy, spent his boyhood in California, then returned to El Paso, where he attended UT El Paso, and then became a journalist for the Wall Street Journal, before moving on to the Dallas Morning News. His new book, Midnight in Mexico, is a memoir about his experiences as a journalist and really as a human being, going back to Mexico, trying to find the word home. Welcome, Alfredo, to Words on a Wire. I know that this book, Midnight in Mexico, took a long time in gestation, and I think it was a real struggle for you, but it really paid off because it's a wonderful book, and it really is both a memoir and a journey going back to find the Mexico you lost. You want to talk about the beginnings of this book and how it began and your struggles with it?
Well, first of all, Ben and Daniel, it's a real pleasure to be with you. Huge fan of the show, and I've actually been looking forward to this for a long time because Ben, I think in many ways you helped me find my voice to write this book. This book was actually in many ways like personal therapy for me. I've been a long-time correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, 20 years, and in 2007 had received the last of four death threats. And that forced me out of Mexico. I ended up doing a fellowship, and I think the distance between Boston and Mexico helped me kind of try to put Mexico in perspective. Mexico is my homeland. I mean, I still feel like I am a son of Mexico. And Mexico has been going through many, many difficult times. So when the interest came to write a book, it was very, very difficult to get away from the sidelines as a journalist. And it was very difficult to try to insert myself to, you know, tell the personal story. You know, what is it like to be a Mexican-American, not a Mexican-American journalist, but a Mexican-American. And so oftentimes you feel like you're carrying, I think, the weight of two countries on you. It took a lot of music to try to kind of go back to certain places that maybe my family had wanted to forget, a lot of soundtracks, and it took a lot of tequila to try to really find myself, you know, find that voice in me. It was a very, very painful struggle. I mean, I think there were a lot of tears that were shed during the writing process.
Alfredo, you say you're a son of Mexico. I think a lot of people in our listening audience really don't know your story. You want to tell them about the village where you were born and grew up in?
I was born in a small town called San Luis de Cordero, Durango, northern part of Durango, right near the border with Chihuahua. And like many towns in Mexico, there's a big tradition of people going north, men going north, women going north. In that time, it was more men. My father was a bracero worker. Started off his, if you want to say, career experience picking cotton chilies in West Texas, New Mexico, and then ended up in California in the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley. And at the age of six, my family, I'm the oldest of nine, my family ended up leaving, and we reunited with my father. But I always tell people that I came kicking and screaming. I didn't want to leave Mexico. I mean, I had what I felt was an idyllic life. You know, we had dollars in the U.S. We walked the streets of San Luis de Cordero as though they belonged to us. I mean, my mother would sing, and people to this day say that when my mother sang, even the rooster stopped to listen. So in some ways, you know, I always wanted to go back. I wanted to reconnect with Mexico and recapture my roots, my culture, my language. And in many ways, I think that's what really journalism has done. It brought me back to Mexico.
We're talking to Alfredo Corchado, author of Midnight in Mexico, here on Words on a Wire. Alfredo, but the return isn't possible, is it?
It's not possible because I think it is and it isn't. I mean, you have this nostalgia about Mexico that doesn't always meet the reality or what Mexico has become. And I think that was the most difficult part. And yet, having said that, I mean, I remain a cautionary optimist. Yes, Mexico has been awash in killings and the so-called drug war. But you also, I think, oftentimes in doing the worst of Mexico, you also see the best of Mexicans. And that, I think, is something that I try to go back in this book, you know, in Midnight in Mexico. I mean, I try to find the hope in Mexico. I mean, I think the title alone, for me, was probably the most hopeful sign. It's midnight in Mexico, but it's the darkest time of the night when you're left still believing in the promise of a new day.
Do you really believe, I mean, you really have a lot of faith, and your book ends that way, that the rains wash away everything except our faith. What gives you that faith in Mexico, that optimism? Because your book, you know, when I finished reading your book, you could read it two ways. You could, I'm alongside you, and I want to have the faith you have. But faith is not something you can borrow, and that's your faith. And because there's so many things in the book that would lead you to the opposite. So tell me why you still have so much faith in Mexico.
Because I'm Mexican. Because, I mean, and I don't mean to be flippant about it, but having, you know, being raised on the border, being raised in El Paso, and being right next to Ciudad Juarez, I think it's kind of where you start to believe in the future. I mean, how is it possible you live next to a city that's, you know, the murder capital of Mexico, some people say the world, et cetera, and you're right up next to El Paso, one of the safest cities in the United States. We're the same people. We have the same aspiration. I think we all believe we can do better. When I say I have faith and I have hope, I'm talking about the people themselves and their resilient spirit. You know, as Mexicans, we're cynical. We can be negative. We can be funny. But I think there's an inherent sense in us that we can be better. We can do better. And I base faith and hope not on the last 6 days or the last 6 years or the last 6 months, but on what I have witnessed as a journalist over the last 20 years. It's a much more open society. We have alternative governments. We have people trying to hold government accountable. Is there something that's going to happen tomorrow? No. I think if anything I've learned in the last, in my time in Mexico, is you're just going to have to continue to be patient. It's going to happen, and it's happening. Sometimes you take one step forward and three backwards, but that's kind of the process of democracy.
We're talking to Alfredo Corchado, author of Midnight in Mexico. Alfredo, this is a timeless book. I think I could read this in 10 years and still love it. And I could read it in 20 years when hopefully the drug wars will be a thing of the past and love the book. But it's also a very timely book, and it gives us insight into the drug wars that has been happening on our borders for the last many, many years. I've been living in El Paso, Juarez for 13 years, and I learned more reading your book than I have been living here
Thank
the whole
you.
Time. But what's really wonderful about this is it starts off with a death threat. You're covering the drug wars. You're covering, perhaps some kickbacks by the government, and someone makes a death threat, and everyone's saying, don't worry, they're not going to kill an American journalist. The problem is, there's this little blurry area. Are you an American or are you not an American? Some say you're not, some say you are. That must have scared the heck out of you.
It scared the heck out of me, and it was also very humbling. And as a, it was this coming to Jesus moment, you know, when you feel you're, yes, you're an American and so forth, and I've lived most of my life in the United States. But it was this guy sitting there and telling me, you have good news and bad news, you know. Good news, they don't go after Americans. Bad news, you don't look American. Mm-hmm. And I think that really forced me to do a lot of soul searching. You know, not just what is an American, but why can't my own colleagues in Mexico have the same kind of protection? Why was, you know, the American government so encouraging, supportive of me, which I eternally am grateful. But even the Mexican government was very, very concerned about my safety. And that, in the end, angered me because it doesn't compare to my colleagues in Mexico. I mean, they just have no protection.
Right. And we'd see images all the time of victims of the drug wars. And once you found out that your life was in danger, that there was, you know, I don't know how you would call it, a hit on you, suddenly the entire landscape, even looking out your window in Mexico City, in your apartment in Mexico City, becomes dangerous. Everything just changes. I love the scene where you're driving and a diesel truck or a big truck comes on one side and another big truck comes on the other side and you're thinking, oh my God, I can't get out of this. How did you negotiate that kind of fear and continue to dig deep into these stories?
Well, I decided to stay for a week because, again, I have a vast, you know, family members throughout Mexico and friends. And I thought, you know, if this is serious, and I took it seriously because the person who warned me is a long-time U.S. source, but I kept thinking, if they can't find me, will they go after a loved one? Will they go after a family member? So I stayed there for 7 weeks, I mean, for 7 days, and I was constantly on the phone back and forth, you know, just checking with as many people as possible. It also forced me to go just to the underbelly, you know, talk to informants, talk to people who I felt were maybe closer to the cartels, and if there was a hit, let them, you know, put the message out. Hey, this is not personal. I'm just a journalist. I'm doing my job. What am I doing wrong? But the other major character in the book is Angela Quacherga.
Right.
Love of my life and longtime journalistic colleague who just kept pressing me, you got to get out now. You got to get out. So it was this constant conflict and conversation that she and I would have. I mean, she finally convinced me that I was nuts and I had to leave.
It's interesting. The Mexican literary establishment tends not to pay attention to Mexican-American writers. And now you have become a Mexican-American writer, which is interesting. But you're in a different space because you're also covering what we might call current events, which is different than a literary thing. Do you think that your point of view will be valued?
So far, from some of the reviews that I've seen, it's been interesting that and these are written by people in the privilege and the elite class, and it's been pretty positive. I mean, it's been pretty encouraging, and at least you believe that maybe they do respect that and they do value that. But I have to knock on wood because I think this is too early. It's really, I mean, it really does have me kind of on pins and needles to see if my homeland embraces me as a son, because I think, you know, you still feel that sense of rejection by the privilege in Mexico, by the elite class in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that somehow this book will serve as a bridge between us and them.
I'm really glad you wrote this book.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I mean, I'm serious. I really appreciate that. Coming from the two of you, es como crema, ¿no?
Thank you for being on our show, Words on a Wire, today, Alfredo. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Un abrazo, Ben.
Un abrazo. Okay.
For our poem of the week, I'm going to do a Neruda poem, Pablo Neruda.
Go.
So this is one of my favorites. The poem in English is called Walking Around. In Spanish, it's also called Walking Around, but I'll read the English version. It so happens I'm tired of being a man. It so happens I enter tailor shops and movie houses, withered, impenetrable, like a swan made of felt, selling the water of ashes and origins. The smell of a hairdresser's has me crying and wailing. I only want release from being stone or wool. I only want not to see gardens and businesses, merchandise, spectacles, elevators. It so happens I'm tired of my feet and toenails, my hair and my shadow. It so happens I'm tired of being a man. Still, it would be a pleasure to scare a lawyer with a severed lily or deal death to a nun with a poke in the ear. It would be good to go through the streets with a green knife and shout out till I died of cold. I don't want to go on being just a root in the shadows, vacillating, extended, shivering with dream, down in the damp bowels of earth, absorbing it, thinking it, eating it every day. I don't want to be so much misfortune. I don't want to go on as a root or a tomb, a subterranean tunnel, just a cellar of death, frozen, dying in pain. This is why Monday, the day, is burning like oil. When it sees me arrive with my prison features, and it screeches going by like a scorched tire, and its footsteps tread hot with blood towards night. And it drives me to certain street corners, certain damp houses, towards hospitals where skeletons leap from the window, to certain cobbler's shops stinking of vinegar, to alleyways awful as abysses. There are sulfur-colored birds and repulsive intestines hanging from doorways of houses I hate. There are lost dentures in coffee pots. There are mirrors that ought to have cried out from horror and shame. There are umbrellas everywhere, poisons and navels. I pass by calmly, with eyes and shoes, with anger, oblivion, pass by, cross through offices, orthopedic stores, and yards where clothes hang down from wires, underpants, towels, and shirts that cry slow, guilty tears. That was Walking Around by Pablo Neruda. On Poetic License this week, we have the poet Paisley Rechdahl, who has been on our show before. She is author of the poetry collections A Crash of Rhinos, Six Girls Without Pants, and most recently, Animal Eye, another collection of poems, and Intimate, a Family Portrait, which is kind of a hybrid text of nonfiction, photography, and poetry, which is really amazing. We're glad to have you on the show. Thank you, Paisley.
Thanks for having me. So I'm going to read a brief essay. I was thinking about literary obscurity. So recently I was given an opportunity that maybe secretly all of us want, to be history's tastemaker. This came in the form of a favor asked of me while standing in line at the local coffee shop where a friendly acquaintance, one of the head librarians at the University of Utah's Marriott Library, also watered. It seems that the library had just come into 500 boxes of poetry books from a now-defunct San Francisco bookseller who specialized in American, British, and British Commonwealth poetry. The collection spanned nearly a century and covered Canada, England, America, parts of Australia, and Scotland. The library had a first-pick opportunity to take the books it wanted for its own permanent collection. The problem, however, was in assessing value, picking and choosing what, among these hundreds upon hundreds of volumes, would be worth investing in. Vanity, thy name is Paisley Rechdahl. Before he'd even finished the sentence, I was eagerly leaping for the task. Me, I'd said as answer to his implied but as yet unstated question. Me, I'm the sucker eager to try my hand at shaping your collection. Little did I know, however, that there were no other people that would be part of this process. Outside of the librarians and staff assigned to alphabetizing and displaying these books, in itself a major task, I would be the only one reading through the books themselves, rifling their pages, searching their copyrights, dates, and places, assessing conditions, reading the poems in the hope of finding what so many writers and editors and readers dream of finding, that elusive, utterly entrancing voice meant for the ages. Of course, the Marriott Library has its own requirements. A regional university wants to represent its region's arts. Clearly, I should choose writers from the Intermountain West, High Desert, and West Coast. Likewise, a library must consider the historical value of particular presses and poetic movements. regardless of an individual's taste for certain aesthetics or bets on longevity, there's deep historical value in preserving the work of small, independent presses that labor to give voice to talent. But hovering above and inside of all these requirements was, of course, the singular and burning hope of finding that something, that someone, that poetic history might otherwise have overlooked. Be honest. Who among us doesn't believe that she would be the one to discover the genius of a Dickinson or perhaps a Melville who, if the story is correct, had faded to utter obscurity when, by happenstance, a scholar of American literature just happened to fish an antiquated copy of Moby Dick from a bookseller's remainder bin? Doesn't each of us snicker, safe from our perch of historical certitude, at the endless lists of moronic editors, collectors, readers, and correspondents who missed the geniuses of their time that were so radiantly, so vividly alive before them? I admit it. I do. I love hearing tales of how the early editors of Dickinson ignored or just flubbed her line breaks in order to conform to current conventional taste. I sigh with relief to hear that W.G. Sebald, though beloved in small circles in his own time, only became a genius after his death, that Hopkins' contemporaries undervalued him, that Elizabeth Bishop was considered a minor poet, far below the rank of her friend and compatriot, Robert Lowell, whom she has now arguably eclipsed, that Shakespeare himself, rightly popular and revered in his own time, had a reputation that was only burnished, and perhaps even academically manufactured, by 19th-century literary scholarship. I love these stories because they give us all hope. They are the American dream as applied to literary history. Hard work and exceptional talent will, regardless of time or critical indifference, win the day. It speaks to the pernicious, sneaking suspicion we all have that most of our contemporaries are, perhaps, just taste continuers, not taste makers. So I dream that perhaps I would be the one who might find the one voice cast aside by circumstance. Perhaps I might be the reader of exceptional taste and judgment who can discern what is merely convention from what is real genius, and in that also go down in the annals of literary history. Along with this are, of course, the darker, sadder fears shared, undoubtedly, by every living poet and artist. I know I'm a minor writer, if that. Perhaps I may not even be a very good one. But these are judgments of my time, my era. Who knows what I could be in 20, 50, 150 years to a different audience? Who knows what any of us could be? The answer is, if these 500 boxes of poetry books is any indication, still not very much. Certainly, 500 boxes of books, over 3,000 volumes of poetry in all, is, when all things are considered, barely a drop in the ocean. It's not even what gets published in a single year in America. Still, this is not a happy thought. I had, in my fantasies, imagined finding treasures to be earthed. What I found were racks of books, pamphlets, self-published tomes with slack staples and skewy margins, dusty volumes from poets with a stack of the best journal publications to their names, and the most unreadable poems you could imagine. I found anthologies of the obsolete, belles lettres of the obscure, chapbooks of the damned. I found volumes by the lesser-known inscribed to the better-known, who later sold them to the shop in order to clear their shelves for other work. I found volumes of bad translations of Welsh poetry and beautifully untouched first editions of Louis MacNeice and Howard Nemiroff. I read through eras of taste, once exalted, now forgotten, overlooked, ignored, maybe even despised. Days went by. One afternoon's highlight was the discovery of an unblemished copy of W.H. Auden's memorial program, the names of Galway Connell and James Merrill, honorary readers at his ceremony, printed in crisp, baby blue letters. Another day's was the uncovering of a book by Fayez Ahmed Fayez's poems, nearly crumbling with age now, published by an obscure Indian press and signed by Fayez himself. Inside the pages of the book were onion-skin letters from editors from England to the now-deceased American poet Carolyn Kaiser, almost assuredly the previous owner of this book. But overall, the hours spent in the library were dispiriting. What had begun in joyous enthusiasm ended in depression. I would go home after work, unable to read the poets I love today with the same confidence or enjoyment. As I flipped through the books, I saw the list of so many others that had come before them, not even 20 or 30 years before them, lying now in a heap of other books that were discarded. Avant experiments seemed stale, beat-influenced lyrics dissolved to solipsism, formal poems hardened to doggerel. As for my own work, I suddenly saw my tendency for filigree and formal playfulness as mere decoration. And if there is anything I learned from my time with these books, it is that the elaborate tended to sour with time, crystallizing like a dessert that's too sweet. Here's where I'm supposed to turn this essay around and offer you, dear listener, and maybe fellow writer, something uplifting. I wish I could. I can offer you some moments of pleasure that I took, finding a poet here or there whose names I'd never heard, but who had written a book of verse that startled me with its clarity and precision of language. I could tell you about the thrill of finding some beautifully printed chapbook put out by a local book arts press, the sensual spell that those creamy pages created as I ran my hand over them. I could talk about the amusing inscriptions that I found, and I could mention the heartbreaking presence of the other writers in their own signatures, inks faded, names almost illegible. Even now, after my own readings, I can't inscribe my name in the flyleaf of one of my books without thinking of these other lost poets, a wave of discomfort and sadness washing through me. No one needs to volunteer to read over 3,000 volumes of poetry to feel the sense of impermanence that hangs over every artwork. And certainly art itself doesn't need to be permanently celebrated to be powerful and important to those who create it, to those who, if even for a few years, choose to keep this art on their shelves. I suppose, over the course of my reading, I'd hope to learn something about what makes a great poem truly, lastingly great. What I've learned instead is the opposite, all the ticks and tricks that go into making a bad poem. I had hoped to learn something I might take away with me into the classroom. If anything, however, I've learned just how mysterious a great poem can be. It's something that can be felt and identified, but can't be mimicked. In that, a great poem is like a fingerprint, a mark of individuality as much as a mark of skill. But have I found any poems that are really and truly great? Or just other poems that are similar enough to the ones that I already love and that I've been taught to love that they get a pass for me into the library's collection? I don't trust my judgment any more now than I did when I started this project. Likely, something wonderful did slip from view. Perhaps I missed the next Dickinson or shunted aside an Aphra Behn. If anything, my time in the library with those thousands of books has taught me nothing more than what I should have already known. Art doesn't last, reputations fade, and what we consider skill and talent are contextual, not always objective. As depressingly practical as this sounds, I still go back to this library to read and sort and select for a collection, probably for the same reasons that I go back to my writing desk. In the end, I abandon the practical in the hopes of being moved. In that, my love for and of literature is as mysterious as a call to God. You have to be chosen, I know. Likely you have to be lucky. But of all things, you have to have faith.
That was Paisley Rechdahl.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We'd like to thank Alfredo Corchado for joining us on Words on a Wire. Don't forget to pick up his book, Midnight in Mexico. It is an incredible journey into the drug wars and into Alfredo himself. And we'd also like to thank Paisley Rechdahl for her very thoughtful poetic license. And we'd like to thank that very obscure Chilean poet, Pablo Neruda, for walking around. From what I understand, this poem is from Residencia en la Tierra. And from what I understand, it's a poem that he wrote when he was walking around Buenos Aires. And so I guess you can do crazy things when you walk around Buenos Aires. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz. We thank Norma Martinez, our producer, and you, our listeners, and you, our listening audience, for sticking with us.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.